SMA News Today, daily digital coverage of spinal muscular atrophy.
Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast, episode 2. I am your host, Kevin Schaefer. Joining me today is Ben Matlin, who is a Los Angeles-based writer living with SMA type 2. Ben is the author of the autobiography, Miracle Boy Grows Up, How the Disability Rights Revolution Saved My Sanity, and the upcoming book, In Sickness and in Health, Love, Disability, and a Quest to Understand the Perils and Pleasures of Interabled Romance. His work has also appeared in publications like the New York Times, the Washington Post, Financial Advisor, and he has been a commentator on NPR. Ben, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, great to be here.
Absolutely. So today we will be talking with Ben about his upcoming book, primarily, and also a little bit about his daily life and his disability advocacy. So, Ben, to start off, let's talk a little bit about your upcoming book. So, whereas your first one is a straightforward memoir, In Sickness and in Health is a series of stories about various couples you've encountered over the years. So, could you talk about this concept of interabled romance and what that means and how this project evolved?
Sure. Well, after Miracle Boy came out, I heard from lots of readers, mostly good, some critical. but there was several people said, we want to hear more about your marriage, your romantic life. And I thought, well, what more can I say? I'm a little bit close to it. I mean, I live it every day. I don't have much perspective. And I really don't want to hold my marriage up as some kind of example. I kind of pondered this for a while. I thought, maybe there is something here, but not just about my marriage, but about other relationships like my marriage. So I began to think about issues in my relationship, my romantic life, questions I had, and began to explore by talking to others. I went through a process of identifying other couples in similar situations. The rule was that one partner has a physical disability and the other doesn't. So there's some at least potential issues of dependency here, interdependency. And I wanted to cover all stages of life, all perspectives, from their young couples in their 20s up through those in their 60s, 70s, different parts of the country, different orientations, to get a sense of what works and what doesn't and how people manage. Basically, they kind of set the record straight because I think there are a lot of misperceptions. People think that couples like my wife and me are exceptional or noble or inspiring. And, you know, we're just couples like any other, dealing with issues like all couples do. But I thought by collecting these different anecdotes, maybe I could kind of record a sense of how these romances work and maybe answer a few questions of my own insecurities. You know, why do some of us last and others don't? That's kind of where I was coming from.
Absolutely. And on that note of misrepresentations about you and your wife, other interabled couples, you've talked and written about times when you and your wife were in public and strangers would regularly assume that she was either your nurse or one of your relatives. So, Yes. Absolutely. And so, based on those encounters, you know, your own experiences and the relationships you've written about in this book, how can the SMA community and just the larger community of people with disabilities change our society's perception of interabled romance?
Well, yeah, every time somebody makes an assumption, like a stranger makes a comment that we don't appreciate, there's always a moment of, do we yell at them? Do we ignore them? Do we try to educate them? Really depends on the moment, I guess, how we're feeling. I don't know. I'd like to see more, media portrayals that are more realistic about relationships. I don't know how we can change people's minds exactly, but I hope that books like mine will, have some effect like that, and also perhaps to reassure those who are insecure about their romantic prospects, people or their parents, we think, they'll never find anybody. It is possible. It does happen all the time, not always easy, but there are certain external factors that are what can be obstacles, and we perhaps could make it easier for these couples. I mean, financial aspects. There's a lot of financial pressures on people with disabilities, and that tends not to make us seem the greatest catch, if we're not employed and have a lot of expenses and all that. So perhaps there are things that could be done in society that would make it easier for kind of encouraging these relationships to really, to do well, to last. Is that an answer? I don't know.
That's a great answer, absolutely. And on that note, too, you and your wife have been married a long time, but in talking with all these different couples for your book, was there anything that really surprised you or that you learned from other couples, be they ones that were younger than you, older than you? What were some of the things you took away from doing these interviews and working on this book?
A couple things occurred to me. First of all, if I were a young guy today, I would probably do a lot more online to meet people, which was not an option back in my day. That's how a lot of young people do meet up. That's kind of great, I think, in a way. One of the couples said to me she has a spinal cord injury and it causes her a lot of physical pain as well as emotional pain. She said she has a psychologist that she can call up and just sort of yell at and complain. Instead of yelling at her partner, she yells at this objective professional. It actually helps her feel better, cope better. I thought that was kind of fascinating. People have their techniques for stress reduction, and it's just kind of good to know there are so many different ways that people manage.
Okay, well, I think that's a good transition point because I wanted to talk a little bit as well about your disability advocacy. And you mentioned that media examples would be a good way of changing the conversation on interabled romance. Sure. I know, of course, there are plenty of negative portrayals of disability and unrealistic ones, but are there any in pop culture or media today which you find to be very positive and accurate depictions of disability?
We do tend to harp on the negative, don't we? In a way, sometimes my favorites are the incidental, or like a TV commercial.
Uh-huh.
Where a little target or somebody has a variety of people, kids and adults, and there's one in a wheelchair, say, or one who's, I don't know, using a cane. I think in a way that's the best. That it's just an incidental treat like any other, not a big deal. That's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
I have liked the show Speechless quite a bit, although not every episode. It does bring up certain important points, or it has, that are not otherwise well known. But it's tricky because even stories, say movies, books based on a true story, are not. You have to tend to use disability, I think, as a. It's sort of exploited as an emblem of something, a problem to solve. The disabled person inspires somebody or changes somebody or is used in some symbolic way instead of just being another person. Disability is it's a fact of life. It's not exceptional, really. It's a pretty common thing. And there are stories around disabilities, but I prefer to see more stories where just disability is incidental, I think, a factor among others in the character's life.
Sure, and yeah, I actually wrote a column about Speechless a few weeks ago, and I do, you know, of course it does get, you know, pretty ABC over the top at times, but I do think it also does a really good job of not only making JJ's life more, you know, normal, and this is just how he does things, but also it does a really good job of commenting on all the stereotypes we face, and I really commend the showrunner for doing that. But also, I know you have contributed to the New York Times section on disability. I was wondering if you read that series regularly.
I do, yeah.
Were there any of those that stuck out to you recently? Or because that's been going on for about a year now, I would say.
About a year.
Yeah.
Yeah, a number of them I like quite a bit. I like the stuff about disability as a sense of identity,
mm-hmm.
where it defines how we feel about ourselves. The author Kenny Freese recently had a piece about the history of disability and the Nazi eugenics program, and I think it's important for all people with disabilities, to know their history, to understand discrimination and all its forms that have existed for forever. People don't know, people forget. I sometimes forget. You're writing about education in this country. I've forgotten how relatively recent integration of kids with disabilities in public schools really is. I mean, it didn't exist when I was in school, hardly. This stuff is pretty new, and we're trying to get there. It can so easily be taken away. But you need to have, I think, a little bit of a civil rights mentality still. That's my soapbox.
Absolutely, and what's really astounding to me is that in this day and age where minorities are so widely discussed in today's media, I find it interesting that disability education is not a priority in public schools and in universities. Do you have any thoughts on that?
That's true. I mean, there are a number of programs in disability studies, which is helpful. I've gotten email from students all over the world who were sort of introduced to these topics, but they don't... But I don't know how widely the message is getting out there. And like all these things, it's progress, but there's still a ways to go.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think, obviously, writing and speaking are some of the best ways to make our voices heard. Are there any other resources or just advice you would have for younger people or anyone with disabilities who wants to get more involved in advocacy and in educating the public about their disability and other disabilities?
Sure. It's you can go online and research and read up, and those who are inclined to write can write things, submit them to New York Times or wherever. There are independent living centers, that used to be anyway, good community kind of consciousness raising places to get involved in community activities. It's good to get out and learn from other disabled folks, I think, online or in person, maybe better in person, see what how people live their lives and give you ideas, and you can give them ideas. So there are a number of ways to become involved. Obviously, there are always protests for those of us so inclined. Joining a chapter of ADAPT or whatever, which is easy. You just say, I want to join ADAPT, and that's about it. There's no dues. There are a lot of ways to become educated and take a stand, so to speak.
Absolutely. Well, and those are great. That's great advice there. Just in closing, if you could just talk a little bit about your daily life and what it entails. I know you have your book coming out in January, and then you're a regular contributor to publications like Financial Advisor, Washington Post, etc. So if you can just talk a little bit about what your daily life is like.
My daily life, well, I work from home. We have, you know, corner of the living room with a laptop with a voice recognition. Most of my work is done there at the computer. I interview a lot by email, sometimes by phone, rarely in person these days. I have a paid assistant every day, and I am married, so my wife fills in evenings and weekends quite a bit. I don't drive my own van. I have to be driven, but what else can I tell you? The op-ed pieces in the New York Times and Washington Post or NPR, I do them because I like to do them. They feel good. They don't pay very much. Quite a number get rejected and maybe become a blog post or just get filed away. It's not a career, unfortunately. The financial journalism, it has to be my, you know, main career to pay the bills. But I hope publishing books and all to balance out my career and generate some attention for things that really matter to me personally.
Absolutely, and you know, I wish you best of luck on your newest book. And on that note, for our listeners out there, where can they pre-order that book or find out more information about it?
It'll be on sale, you know, wherever books are sold, in all formats, audio or ebook or print. Probably best to go to the Beacon website. I think it's beacon.org. Let me check that. Maybe you can search under my name or under In Sickness and In Health. And that'll give you links to different sellers for pre-ordering. Obviously, there's Amazon, but there are others. let me just check the website.
And your website is www.benmatlin.com, correct?
That's an easier way.
Cool. Awesome.
Of course. It's beacon.org.
Awesome. Well, yeah, so listeners out there, be sure to pre-order that and pick it up in stores. It's scheduled for release on January 30th, I believe.
Yes.
Awesome.
That's correct.
Awesome. Well, Ben, I just want to say thank you for joining us today, and it was a pleasure talking with you. As I said, you can find out more information about Matlin's work at his website, www.benmatlin.com. You can follow him on Twitter, @BenMatlin. The SMA News Today podcast is available on SoundCloud and on our website at www.smanewstoday.com. Be sure to follow us for daily digital coverage of spinal muscular atrophy. I'm Kevin Schaefer, community editor for SMA News Today.